This is the best of the Narrow Path Radio broadcast. The following is pre-recorded.
Welcome to the Narrow Path Radio program, hosted by Steve Gregg. Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be able to be taken. In the place of the usual format, we've put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. In addition to the radio program, The Narrow Path has a website you can go to, www.thenarrowpath.com, where you can find hundreds of resources that can all be downloaded for free. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path.
Morris from Costa Mesa, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just want to preface this conversation by giving you a quick background of why I'm going to be asking this question. First of all, I was in the Christian music business in the 80s and preached the gospel from the stage, so on and so forth. And then right in the pinnacle of my career, I started having a rare ear disorder, which completely destroyed my career in that business. So I essentially was angry at God for a number of years and walked away from Christ. In the last year, I've rededicated my life to Christ. And, I mean, it's been off and on over the years. And now, as I look at the New World Order encroaching very speedily on the United States and bringing in the one world government, I just want to know, how do I know I'm saved? I mean, I pray, I read my Bible, I am dating a girl that doesn't know Christ, and I witnessed to her many times, and it's just a nightmare because I'm having these panic attacks every morning because I see that this New World Order encroaching quicker and quicker and quicker on Christianity and bringing in the one world government with the Antichrist and everything. And I just, it's very difficult for me to deal with this. And I feel like I'm losing my mind.
All right. Well, let me just say that I never give counsel that's conditioned on the assumption that the tribulation and the Antichrist are right around the corner, because I think we need to live the Christian life exactly the same way if Jesus is coming back this evening or if he's not going to be back for 1,000 more years. The Christian life is the same no matter what time you're living in, and I think it can be a distraction to be focused too much on whether the New World Order is coming in, whether the Antichrist is around the corner. It may well be that such things are about to break forth. But I would just caution you, there's been many, many generations of Christians who've thought the very same thing about their own times. And I myself was also in a Christian band like you, music ministry in Southern California, and going to Costa Mesa Calvary Chapel and so forth. And we were quite convinced in the 70s that the New World Order and the Antichrist and the rapture and all that were imminently upon us. And obviously that was more than 40 years ago, getting close to 50 years ago now. And, you know, it may be that Jesus is coming this week or this year or next year, but it may be he's not. You know, our prophecy teachers were certainly telling us that everything was lined up in 1970 for it all to come immediately down. That's one reason I didn't go to college. I thought, got no time to graduate. Just go out and hit the streets and evangelize. So that's what I did. And, you know, obviously it was wrong-headed. I'm not saying it was wrong-headed not to go to college, but it was wrong-headed to think that I needed to dictate my behavior on the assumption that the second coming was immediate, because as I know from my present perspective, it wasn't, and it may not be now. But it may be. I mean, terrible things are happening in the world, but there have on many times in history been terrible things happening in the world, and Christians have to face the fact that Jesus said, in this world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. And even if we're not living in the last days, that is, before the coming of Christ, what I mean is if Jesus does not come in the next 50 years, I'll be dead in less than 50 years. So Jesus, I'm in my last generation. I don't know if the world is in its last generation, but I'm certainly in mine. And therefore, I need to live every day as if that might happen tomorrow, whether I believe it's the second coming of Christ or my own death. I could die in an accident today. And therefore, knowing that you're saved is a fairly important thing, regardless of what times you're living in, okay? That's the first thing I want to say. And I say it that way because if anything should happen that would postpone the rise of the Antichrist in your thinking, I don't want you to think, oh, well, I was getting ready for the Antichrist, but now I've got a breather. I don't have to live for God the same way. Unfortunately, that's what a lot of people did in the 70s. They read The Late Great Planet Earth. They heard the preaching of the imminent rapture, imminent tribulation. They knew they better get on board so they don't go into the tribulation. That was the thinking in the 70s. But then when the 70s progressed halfway through the decade, a lot of people saying, hey, I was misled, and they fell away because they weren't really committed to Christ. They were committed to saving their skin. And when you're committed to saving your skin, you're still not denying yourself. You're committed to you, not to Christ. You need to be committed to Christ to the degree that if he would take away your voice and your hearing and every pleasure you have and throw you into a dungeon and you were tortured day and night, you'd still love him because he's worth it to you. Anything short of that is still coming to Christ as a negotiator or as someone trying to get something for oneself primarily. Now, of course, we get something tremendous when we get saved, but our motivation has got to be that if I got nothing out of this at all, God deserves my loyalty. I was asked a question once when I was about 19 by a friend saying, if there was no heaven or hell, if Jesus appeared to you and said there's no heaven or hell, would you still serve me? What would you say? After only a moment, I thought, well, the question is a trick question, isn't it? I mean, of course I'd serve him. Serving him isn't about heaven and hell. It's about him. He deserves to be served. He's worthy. I think that's what the gospel is based on, is the worthiness of Jesus, not the escape route for us sorry sinners to get out of what we deserve. What we need is that God gets what he deserves from us. And that Christianity is a God-centered faith, not a man-centered. So you're scared to death. It's the last days. Antichrist is coming. You're having panic attacks. In all likelihood, you're having those because you're still thinking an awful lot about your own safety and well-being. And I don't blame you. Everybody thinks about that some. But if you're going to follow Christ and survive the next test, see, you didn't pass the last test. You were serving Christ. You were tested by having your ears affected so you couldn't do what you wanted to do. And instead of saying, well, God, I guess it's a change of plans. What do you want for me to do next? You just got mad at God and went the other way, which means you failed the test. God was testing to see if you're in it for him or for you. And you proved you were in it for you. But you don't have to be in it for you this time. You can be in it for him this time. Make sure you are. Because Job, for example, was in it for God. He said, even if he slays me, I'll still trust him. In other words, I'm loyal to God even if it kills me. He's taken my family from me. He's taken my property. My health is gone. And if he takes my life too, well, that doesn't change a thing. I'm still going to trust him. That's a God-centered religion as opposed to a self-centered religion. And Job didn't even have the law. He was like an ancient saint. We're Christians. We have Christ, and we should know that's all about him. And so the way to know you're saved is to do a check. Will I serve God no matter what happens, by his grace? Not because I'm a tough Christian, but because I'm a weak Christian who trusts in God and his grace is sufficient. So I expect that when the trials come, if the Antichrist wants to cut my head off or whatever it is that my eschatology tells me is going to happen, will I go for that or not? There's a caller who used to call me on this program once in a while. A couple times he said, well, if the mark of the beast comes, I'm going to take the mark. I said, well, why would you do that? He thought he was a Christian. He said, well, because I won't be able to buy or sell. I'll starve to death. So I'll take the mark. I thought, I don't understand your mentality. You mean you'd rather deny Christ than die? Then what does your commitment to Christ mean? Jesus said, if anyone seeks to save his life, he'll lose it. But he that will lose his life for my sake shall find it. You need to ask yourself, am I in this life of Christianity for me? Or I am in it for Christ. If it's for Christ and for God, and you say, I'm nothing, it doesn't matter what happens to me, I'm denying myself, taking up my cross, I'm following him no matter what, If that's your attitude, then you can be pretty sure you're a Christian, because non-Christians don't think that way. But I would recommend something else, too. At my website, thenarrowpath.com, if you go to the tab that says Topical Lectures, there's a series called How Can I Know If I'm Really Saved? And it's an in-depth study of the book of 1 John, going through John gives four tests. He says, if this is true of us, we know we're born again. We know we pass from death into life. We know he dwells in us, and so forth. There are four tests of whether you're saved or not. And it'd be a good way to check yourself out. So if you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, go to the tab that says Topical Lectures, and then find the series called How Can I Know That I'm Really Saved? And listen to those lectures. I think it'll help you out. And since, you know, you are having some panic and so forth about this, I would say that it's definitely worth your investment of the time to listen and to examine yourself. Because Paul says in 2 Corinthians 13, examine yourselves and see if you're in the faith. And that's something that people ought to do probably more often than they do. People often just assume they're saved. But then a test like the one you went through kind of shows, oops, I guess I didn't have that commitment, did I? So examine yourself and see. I can't tell you if you're saved or not, but I can tell you how to test it. And that's what I'm recommending. If you listen to those lectures, I think it could help.
Am I still on?
Yes.
One of the things also that gets me is the stress over all the people that I know that I try to convince of the second coming and of Christ, and I feel responsible for all these other people too, which is very stressful.
Well, you probably do bear some responsibility for some people, but everyone bears his own responsibility too. I mean, if somebody has heard about Christ and has done nothing to seek him and to know him, the responsibility rests entirely on them. I shouldn't say entirely, but heavily. It's their responsibility to make the decision. Truly, we may bear some responsibility for their unbelief if it is our testimony and our example that turned them off to Christ. That is something to be concerned about. If I say I'm a Christian, and they know I say I'm a Christian, but the way I behave advertises that I'm probably not a real Christian, or I'm not being what Christ said I should be, they might just conclude Christianity is fake. It was to that guy. Maybe it is for everybody. And then they may not consider it. So, I mean, there are things we can do that may stumble people. And Jesus said, woe unto those by whom those stumbling blocks come. It's better to have a millstone around your neck and cast in the sea than to stumble one of them. But whatever you may have done along those lines in the past, you don't have to keep doing. You can be forgiven. But as far as being responsible for the salvation of everyone you know, I don't think that you bear personal responsibility for everyone you know, but I do think you should be open to God's leading when he tells you to speak to somebody about Christ. I think you should be following Christ in such a way that people are curious to say, why is it you live the way you do? Because Peter said in 1 Peter 3:15 that we should be ready always to give an answer to anyone who asks us a reason for the hope that is in us. Why are you living this way? Why do you think the way you do? The way you live should be distinctive enough that people will sometimes ask that question. You should be prepared to answer. But you don't have to buttonhole every non-Christian you see and not let them pass until they've said the sinner's prayer. It'd be nice if we could do that, but that's not really possible, and God doesn't expect you to do that. What you need to do first is make sure that you are committed to God at the level that he requires, and then that you're obedient to him, which will include talking to people about Christ when that subject naturally comes up or when you feel led to bring it up. But I said, listen to those lectures first. That's your main issue. Your main issue is knowing that you're saved. And those lectures, How Can I Know That I'm Really Saved, is what I would recommend for you. I'm running low on time, so I have to take some more calls. I'm glad you called, though, Morris.
Let's talk to Brian from Mission Viejo, California. Brian, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. You know, I had two questions, and if we could just get one in. The question was I asked the screener was in the book of Titus the legitimacy of bishops given in within those parameters of the book of Titus chapter 1 verses 5 through 12 and what bishops would adhere to the word of God in order to be a lawful bishop. And my really primary question is there's deception, and I know that in the book of Matthew 5:34 it talks about do not swear an oath or the earth is his footstool and heaven's his throne. And so we have presidents, except for one, that have sworn on the Bible. But there's one that didn't, and his name was Theodore Roosevelt, because he actually read the Bible. And so I'm wondering, the deception that we have when we swear oaths or we are not legitimate, could you kind of give us an understanding of, is it just because we want to be right, we want to be God, and we don't humble ourselves to the mighty hand of God? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, please don't go yet. Don't go yet, because it sounded like you had a question about bishops, and you had a question about swearing oaths, right?
It says that the bishop of Rome, or I'm sorry, that any bishop, must be married, one wife, with children that are not accused of unruly or riot, and not to be soon angry. So if I don't have that qualification, then I should not be called a bishop, or I should not even seek that office. And first you want to be a bishop, too. But there are qualifications, is that correct?
Yeah, there's a long list of qualifications of bishops, yes. Most people in that office probably don't qualify on all those points. You're right.
Wow. That's like the blind leading the blind.
Yeah. Well, I'll be glad to address those issues.
Okay, great.
Okay, Brian.
I think my answer off the phone. And like I said, the swearing thing, it's just if we would read his word more and do his word, I believe we'd be in a lot better shape.
All right. Well, God bless you.
Thanks.
Appreciate your call.
All right.
Well, as far as the qualification for bishops, you have to remember the word bishop. We might think of bishops in connection with certain liturgical hierarchical churches like the Roman Catholic or Episcopal churches, or and say, you know, a bishop is some kind of a high-ranking official like the Bishop of Rome, who's the Pope, or something like that. Actually, the word bishop is simply, in the Greek, it's episkopos, which means an overseer. Now, an overseer was the same thing as an elder. In fact, in Titus chapter 1, verse 5, he says to appoint elders in every city, and if a man's a husband of one wife, because an overseer, it says bishop in some translations, an overseer must be blameless and so forth. Now, an elder and an overseer are the same thing, and it's not a liturgical office, in my opinion. I don't believe it's a ecclesiastical office. I believe that it's simply a recognition that there are certain people that God has put in the church who oversee the church because that's where their heart is. They've got a shepherd's heart, and they watch over people. They don't have authority over the private lives of people. Paul said he didn't have dominion over people's lives. Even the ones that he converted, he didn't have dominion over them. He said in 2 Corinthians 1:24, I think it is. Or the last verse in 2 Corinthians 1, he said, we don't have dominion over your faith. You stand by your own faith. And that was an apostle talking. Certainly the elders didn't have dominion over people. They were simply servants who would make sure that the weaker sheep were not going astray and so forth. Just, they'd look out for people, like an older brother might look out for a younger brother. And that's what Jesus said. Jesus said the rulers of the Gentiles call themselves, well, they exercise authority over each other. And he said, it shall not be so among you, but with you, you're all brothers. Don't call anyone father. Don't call anyone teacher. You're all brothers. And so the church definitely has strayed from the whole idea of Jesus' teaching and Paul's, that there are people who are, gifted to provide leadership. But leadership isn't being the boss. Leadership is being an example. And there are people who teach, and there are people who do those things. But I don't think Jesus or Paul set up the church as a political institution with political leaders who exercise some kind of a hierarchical authority over each other's lives. At least we don't read of that. And when we do read of someone doing that, it's not a good thing. For example, Diotrephes in 3 John, it loves to have the preeminence, and he seems to be not someone that John approves of. Now, when a person is recognized as an overseer, I think they should meet the qualifications that the Bible gives. And therefore, the first qualification for overseers, according to Titus 1, and also 1 Timothy 3, that also gives the qualifications of an overseer or a bishop, is that they must be married. Husband of one wife, they have to have children, they have to be a ruler over a home to show that they can take care of the church of God. They have to know that they...
we have to be able to see that they can manage their family before we put them in any kind of recognition of managers of God's family. And so, you know, the popes and the bishops of the Roman Church obviously don't meet those qualifications, so they're not bishops. That is to say, they wouldn't qualify as bishops in the Bible, because the first qualification is to be a family man. And the Roman Catholic Church has taken the position that a bishop and a priest and a pope cannot be married at all. Strange, too, because Peter was married, and he's supposedly the first of the popes, according to the Roman Catholics. Peter had a wife. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 9 that Peter took a wife around with him when he traveled. We know that early in the teaching of Jesus, or in the ministry of Jesus, he went to Peter's house and healed Peter's mother-in-law. Well, you don't have a mother-in-law unless you have a wife. And so Peter clearly was married, and the Bible confirms that more than one place. And he was made an apostle, as were others. And apparently all the apostles were married except for Paul. And Barnabas was not married. Paul indicates that he and Barnabas were notable exceptions to this in 1 Corinthians 9. So I think your complaint is that the Roman Church has, you know, appointed themselves bishops and paid no attention whatsoever to the qualifications of bishops, and therefore ended up appointing bishops who don't qualify biblically to be bishops. But not only the Roman Church, most churches that have elders, many of them, I should say, have elders that would not qualify on some or another of the qualifications that Paul gives. And that's a shame. People should hold out for that. I think churches should be looking for the people who actually meet the qualifications for eldership before they recognize somebody as an elder in the church. As far as swearing oaths is concerned, that has been understood a variety of ways. You mentioned people should just read the Bible more. Well, even people who read the Bible have taken that in various ways, for the simple reason that when Jesus said in Matthew 5, you have heard that it was said, you shall not perjure yourself, but the oaths you've made to the Lord, you must keep them. Jesus said, well, I'd just say, don't even swear. You know, don't even bother to swear. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. If Jesus is saying, do not swear, and that's like a command, like similar to love your enemy, well, then, yes, it would be wrong to swear, in a court of law, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It'd be wrong to make a marriage vow, because you make an oath there, too. It'd be wrong to affirm anything beyond just yes or no. And yet, in the Old Testament, God actually urged Israel to swear in his name as opposed to swearing in the names of other gods. Swearing an oath was a way of sealing a deal in ancient times. Sometimes when we think of swearing, we think of cussing or using profanity. That has nothing to do with, you know, when he says don't swear. We're not talking about profanity. We're talking about establishing an oath, which was how contracts were sealed rather than in writing. Today we sign on the dotted line when we make a contract, and that's how we bind ourselves. In earlier days in our country, they might have sealed it with a handshake, and a man's handshake was considered to be binding. In Middle Eastern times, Middle Eastern biblical times, I should say, people would seal a deal with an oath. I swear by whatever, God or the temple or whatever. Now, Jesus criticized the Pharisees in Matthew 23 because they made a difference between certain kinds of oaths. They said if a person swears by the temple, it doesn't count for anything, but if he swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. And Jesus criticized them for that, and he said, don't you know that the temple is just as holy as the gold, even more so? And so implying that you should be bound whether you swear by the temple or by the gold of the temple. Similarly, he said, if you Pharisees say if you swear by the altar, it doesn't matter, it doesn't count, you're not bound. But if you swear by the gift on the altar, then you're bound. She said, well, same thing. The altar is what makes the gift sacred. So, I mean, swearing by the altar, swearing by the gift, it's all the same. And what Jesus is not saying that swearing is wrong there. He's simply saying it's wrong for you to think that some oaths don't count. And that's exactly what was going on in Jewish society. The Pharisees were the legal experts. They knew all the ins and outs of the rabbinic laws. These were not God's laws. These were the rabbis' traditional laws. And they did have traditions. Some oaths are binding, some are not. So if you make a business deal and you swear by the altar in Jerusalem, the average person would think, okay, well, you'll certainly count yourself bound to this oath because you swore by the altar in Jerusalem. But if you don't pay up later on and they say, hey, I thought you swore that you'd do such and such a thing, you'd say, well, oh, I didn't swear by the gift on the altar. My swearing by the altar, that wasn't binding. And therefore, they would take it to be, you could make certain oaths to deceive people. Making any kind of oath gives the impression you're going to keep your word. And yet, if you knew there's some oaths that most people didn't know about that were technically not binding, then you could deceive people even in taking oaths. And Jesus said, that whole thing has become so corrupt, don't even swear. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. He's not so much saying that taking oaths is itself evil. He's simply saying the way that oaths are taken in his society have become just another form of deceiving people. Just be honest. When you say yes, count yourself bound by your integrity, by your yes. If you say no, count yourself bound by your no. And I think he's just teaching we need to be honest with or without swearing oaths, because there are oaths that even Jesus would put under oath in court, and he seemed to allow it. And Paul, too, put himself under oath in some of his letters. So I don't know that the oath is the problem. I think needing an oath or using an oath to deceive people and trying to deceive is what the problem is that Jesus was addressing. But we're kind of out of time for that. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We're going to take a break, and some of our stations are going to leave the network. Those of you who are leaving, I want you to know The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can go to our website and get all kinds of free things, but you can also donate there if you want to. The website is thenarrowpath.com. You can also listen to the other half of the program if you want to from the website at thenarrowpath.com. The rest of you, please stay tuned for 30 seconds. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
This is the best of the Narrow Path Radio broadcast. The following is pre-recorded.
Welcome to the Narrow Path Radio program, hosted by Steve Gregg. Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be able to be taken. In the place of the usual format, we've put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. In addition to the radio program, The Narrow Path has a website you can go to, www.thenarrowpath.com, where you can find hundreds of resources that can all be downloaded for free. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path.
All right, let's talk to, we got our lines full now, Stan from Newburgh, Oregon. Stan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. Thanks for answering maybe the same questions over and over.
Sometimes.
But I don't know if you've discussed America's calling sanctuary cities, if it's even close to being what Joshua talked about being those cities of refuge, if there's any correlation or what really was the city of refuge in Jewish times.
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't know that there's any correlation to it. A city of refuge in the Bible was someplace where a murderer who had murdered accidentally could flee to. So this was a person who had committed a crime, but accidentally. He didn't intend to. It was an accidental crime. It was involuntary manslaughter. Though it was involuntary, it was still considered something that could not be ignored. And so the person who had accidentally killed somebody could flee to one of the cities of refuge. There were six of them. There were three on each side of the Jordan and one in each major area of Israel, so that hopefully it wouldn't be too far for someone to flee to if he deserved to. Now, once he came to the city of refuge, there were courts of law there that his case would be heard, and they would try his case to see if he had murdered on purpose or accidentally. If it was determined that it was, in fact, involuntary manslaughter, he would be allowed to stay in the city of refuge and would not be allowed to be put to death unless he left the city. If he left the city of refuge, he would be put to death. Even though it was involuntary manslaughter, the city of refuge was the only safe place for him because there were relatives, probably, of the man who had died who would want to take vengeance on him, and he would be protected from them only in the city of refuge. Now, this would be true until the high priest died. Once the high priest died, he could leave. Or, of course, he was there till he died otherwise. This really doesn't have much resemblance to what we call sanctuary cities, which aren't places for criminals per se to flee to, certainly not murderers. And a person who is a deliberate criminal could not flee to our city of refuge in the Bible. If he deliberately committed a crime, he would be put to death there in the city of refuge too. The city of refuge enforced the crimes. That is the criminal penalties on crimes. So, I mean, a city of refuge was very specifically for one special kind of situation where a person had accidentally killed someone, had not intended to do it, and wanted to be spared, his life to be spared from the anger and vengeance of the family, of the one who died. And he could be spared if he was truly innocent in that sense. Now, sanctuary city is an entirely different kind of thing. It's a place where people who are deliberately breaking the law, that is, they've come into a country in violation and defiance of that country's laws, and they're living illegal in the country. That means they're breaking the law. Illegal means breaking laws. You can't be doing something illegal without breaking laws. So they're living illegally, breaking laws on purpose, and living in a country that has not given them permission to be there. Now, every country has the right to decide who will live in their country and who will not, and each country has their own policies. Mexico, for example, if you go into their country and try to live there illegally, they'll put you in jail, probably forever. You know, every country has their own laws about the terms on which you can live there, and they have the right to make those laws. It's their borders, their law, their country. Our country has its laws, and some people break the laws. And those who do so usually do so knowingly, and therefore it's not accidental, not like the man who was guilty of involuntary manslaughter. That was not intended by the individual. So there's really nothing similar. And even in our sanctuary cities, not everyone there is thought to be a major criminal, like a murderer, as was the case with the cities of refuge, but usually just someone who's living illegally in the country. So, I mean, I don't know if some people are making that connection, but if they are, they certainly are not thinking very clearly about what the cities of refuge were in the Bible.
Yeah, that sounds like what I kind of believe there too, Steve. It seems like a place for refuge in America now, because I used to work in the jail, and it seemed like it was a place for the criminal to go to be protected, like you're saying, in the city from families who might be after him to take vengeance themselves, and then the justice system would then take over to either send the illegal immigrant back to the country of origin or to give them the safety
It's an entirely different situation. It doesn't have any parallels.
Exactly. Thanks for the answer, Steve. Blessings to you, and have a good day.
Okay, Stan, thanks. God bless you. Good talking to you. Dwight, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thank you, Steve. I have a question about legalism. I wonder if you could give me what your definition of legalism is.
Well, you know, the word legalism isn't really found in the Bible, but we use the term to speak of a certain religious mood or attitude, which is very deadly, frankly. I mean, when we read the book of Galatians and we read about the Judaizers that Paul was denouncing there, we would have to say they were what we call legalists. They were requiring Christians to come under the law of Moses. And Paul said a number of things. He said, first of all, they're preaching a different gospel because of that. And he also said that they had a different spirit. He said that they had been beguiled or bewitched into believing this. And I personally think that legalism at its root is a spiritual thing. I think it's an evil spirit. I don't mean to say that legalistic people are necessarily demon-possessed, but I believe that there's an influence, a spiritual influence that's evil, that leads people into legalism. Now, what is legalism? It's the idea that basically people need to measure up, essentially. That is, they need to perform, to earn through good works or through laws, God's favor. And therefore, it transforms the grace of God, which is the actual means by which God receives us, into a contract where we perform a certain amount and God repays us for that. And many Christians have this view, although in many cases their official doctrine as Protestants would be that we're justified by faith apart from works. Almost all Protestants would say that if they know anything about Protestant theology, but even those who say that still come under a legalistic spirit at times. And you'll find people judging each other on the basis of rules, basically, religious rules, perhaps. Maybe judging people by their appearance, by their failure to do enough religious things that they think are the right things. Now, and this becomes a divisive matter. When Christians begin to judge others on a basis other than what God judges us on. Now, God does judge us, and God will judge us according to our works. And therefore, many times people mistake legalism for something else. Actually, true Christianity calls us to be obedient to Christ. Mm-hmm. True Christianity is the embracing of Christ as Lord. And if he's our Lord, that means that we understand that we're to obey him. If we were to earn our acceptance with God by obedience, we'd all fall short. And that's another thing about legalists, is they're not in touch with reality. They often will judge other people as not perfect. And by their own self-assessment, they think themselves to be not guilty. And they usually have a double standard. They'll, like Jesus said, they'll try to get a speck out of somebody else's eye when they've got a beam in their own eye. I think the features of a legalistic spirit, we can see them in Galatians. We can see them in the Pharisees also. One is that they major on minors. That is, they consider the tedious little ritual rules and regulations to be more important than love. Remember, Jesus said of the Pharisees that they pay their tithe of mint, anise, and cumin, but they neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. So, in other words, they neglect love, which is justice and mercy and faithfulness, and they emphasize religious duty, like paying tithes. And that's a Pharisaic thing. That's what we'd call a legalistic thing, making small things important and big things being neglected or unimportant. And, as I say, another is a hypocritical judgment, where one is using a double standard. They're judging other people, but they don't behave well themselves. Remember, Jesus said the scribes and the Pharisees lay heavy burdens, grievous to be borne, on men's shoulders, but they won't lift a finger to carry them themselves. So I'd say these are some of the features of legalism, being judgmental, being hypocritical in judgment, or at least using a double standard, judging by the wrong rules, certainly, that is, majoring on minor things and neglecting the major things. But the primary thing at the root of all of that is the attitude that thinks that God will accept you if you do enough good things or the right things. Now, I believe God accepts us on the basis of our faith in Jesus Christ, and that our faith in Jesus Christ results in a life seeking to be obedient to him. And obedience to God is not legalism. But if we think that our obedience to God is what God is going to accept us by or not, then I think that we fall into the legalistic mentality.
Mm-hmm. I've heard people say that they think fasting is legalistic, and yet I think Jesus commanded it, didn't he? Or pretty much expected that we would do it.
Right. Jesus didn't command it, but he did seem to expect it. He said to his disciples,
right,
when you fast, do this and don't
right.
do that. And he also said to John's disciples, my disciples don't fast while I'm here, but while I'm gone, they'll fast. So although he didn't command it, he certainly saw it as something his disciples would do, at least
right.
on some occasion. Now, fasting is not legalistic unless it's legalistic. And what I mean by that is, if you're fasting because that's what God puts on your heart to do, and you're doing it out of obedience to the moving of His Spirit in your life, then that's not legalism. That's just being obedient. But there are people who certainly are legalistic about fasting. They'll set a schedule for fasting, and they'll fast that day of every week, let's put it that way. And then they'll judge other people for whether they're fasting or not. And that's what the Pharisees did. That can be legalistic. But nothing is legalistic if you're not doing it for legalistic reasons. Legalism is an attitude and a spirit.
Okay.
It's not a certain number of things you do. For example, Paul was very much opposed to the Galatians baptizing themselves. I mean, not baptizing, excuse me, circumcising themselves. And yet we sometimes will circumcise. My sons are circumcised. But it wasn't for religious reasons. You know, Paul said to the Galatians, if they get circumcised, they're under obligation to keep the whole law. In other words, they're coming under this law thing, this legalism thing, if they get circumcised. But that's because that's why they were doing it. They were doing it to come under the law. Nowadays, children might be circumcised for hygienic reasons. It's not the idea of doing it. It's the reason for doing it. It's the attitude and the mentality behind doing it. Legalism, you know, whether it comes to fasting or circumcision or church attendance or drinking alcohol or smoking or anything like that. I mean, those are things that some Christians judge other people about, which the Bible doesn't give authorization for. And that's another thing about legalism. It often emphasizes rules that are man-made instead of biblical rules. So if I could maybe just summarize some of the things I said, I think legalism is an attitude or a spirit, and it looks like this. It's judgmental. Judges by a double standard, usually, which means that the person doing the judging isn't living up to the standards they're even judging others by. They may be judging with man-made rules instead of what the Bible says, so that what they're expecting of people is not really obedience to God, but obedience to some human ideas of what should be done. And they tend to major on small matters, matters that are small in God's sight, compared to the weightier matters of the law, which usually you're not focused on. Because if you're focused on love, which is the weightier matters of the law, if you're focused on love, you're not going to be legalistic. You're not going to be judgmental. You're going to be sympathetic.
Right.
If people are failing, you're going to be sympathetic toward them and wishing to help them do better. So those are my thoughts in a nutshell on that subject.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Dwight, thanks for your call.
God bless you.
God bless you, too. Bye now.
All right, Kelvin from Seaside, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, Steve?
Good.
Hey, I have a question. I keep hearing Lucifer, and I know I heard you a while back. Lucifer isn't Satan, right? When I'm reading the Bible, I just can't find this in there, but I did find Lucifer. But
the devil,
I hear these churches saying, well, Lucifer this, Lucifer that.
Yeah, there's no place in the Bible where the devil is called Lucifer.
Right, the devil is the devil and Satan, right?
Right, yeah, Satan is what he's usually called.
That's man-made, Lucifer, and I just wanted to clear that up. Now, how about this 666? Is that related to the devil or what?
666 is the mark of the beast in Revelation chapter 13, and it's it is said to be the emblem of a man's name. In the biblical times, in the Roman Empire, there were what they called gematria, where they would sometimes spell out words in code using a numeric equivalent of the letters in order to spell out a word or a name. Almost all scholars are of the opinion that 666 is an example of a gematria, that it represents somebody's name. And, it's fairly reasonable to suggest that, because what it actually does say is it's the number of his name. It says that in Revelation 13, 17, that no one may, well, let me give 16 and 17. He, the beast, causes both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Now, it's the number of a man's name, it says. You have to have his name, his number, the number of his name. It's 666. Now, notice that John assumes that his readers
would be able to figure out who he's talking about, what name he has in mind. Because he says, and his readers, of course, lived 2,000 years ago. He's writing to seven churches in Asia, which are not there anymore, but they were there when he wrote to them. And he said to them, those of you who have understanding, I expect you can figure out who I'm referring to here. If you calculate the number I'm talking about, it's a man's name. It's 666. And so most scholars would agree that this is talking about the name of somebody that is reduced to a numerical equivalent in the language. Now, there are three languages that are relevant to the Bible times that would perhaps be considered. One is Greek, one is Latin because of the Roman Empire, and one was Hebrew. All of these languages used their alphabet for numbers. That is, instead of having a separate numerical system, they gave a numerical evaluation to the letters of their alphabet. And then they would lay out letters and give them a numerical value. Now, you also would have a numeric system if you wanted to use it, but you could take any word and any name and take the letters in it and say, okay, this letter is worth this number and this letter for that one, and add them up. And this was done. I mean, we know of secular examples of this happening, that someone wrote a name in code by using its number. And that's what John seems to be doing here. Let me tell you his name. It's 666. You have to use some wisdom to figure out who I'm talking about. But is he thinking of Greek or Hebrew or Latin letters? Irenaeus thought it should be in Greek because the revelation was written in Greek. But if it was really trying to conceal the identity of somebody who was actually living at the time, and it must be because he thought that those living at the time would be able to recognize the name of the person, then Greek would not conceal it very well because, frankly, the person being described is very prominent. He describes this person as one that the whole world is following, and he persecutes Christians, and he's, very powerful, strong government authority. And therefore, there would be a limited number of people whose names you could try against the Greek language and figure out what 666 would be. But it would appear that John wanted to not to be obvious in case perhaps the letter fell into the wrong hands. Didn't want the enemies to be able to figure out what he's saying. But he thought the church could. Now, why would the church be able to figure it out and the Roman enemies would not? The Romans certainly knew Greek and they knew Latin, but they didn't know Hebrew. Most Romans would not know any Hebrew. And yet the readers of Revelation, though they were not Hebrew-speaking, they knew some Hebrew. We know this because the book of Revelation has some Hebrew words in it. Amen and Alleluia are both Hebrew words. The name of the angel of the bottomless pit is given in Greek and in Hebrew, Abaddon and Apollyon. And so there is some intermixture of knowledge of Hebrew assumed by the readers. And if he wanted the readers to be able to decipher this name, but not the enemies, then using Hebrew would be the most sensible language to use. Now, if you think of the names of the most powerful people in John's time, which could be possibly referred to here as the beast, there is one that the numbers, his name would in Hebrew come out to 666. That's Caesar Nero. When you translate his name into Hebrew and take the number of the Hebrew letters, it comes out to 666. So many scholars think that he's referring to Nero and that the number of the beast then is indicating Nero, who is the persecutor of the church, probably at the time Revelation was written. Now, there's a lot of people who disagree with that because they think that Revelation was written a long time after Nero's day. Nero died in 68 AD, and many people think that the book of Revelation was written almost 25 years later. Maybe even more. No, not maybe 20 years later. Maybe around 30 years later. What would it be? Yeah, they're thinking of it in 96. So that'd be a long time later, over 30 years later. And if that's true, then it couldn't be a reference to Nero. But in my opinion, Revelation was written before the death of Nero. And I think probably the number is referring to Nero. If it is not, then we'd have to be at a loss to know who it's referring to because there was no one else, either in the time of Nero or in the time of Domitian, the emperor 30 years later, that some people think Revelation was written during. There's no one in that time, the emperor or anyone else that we know of, that's name would reduce to 666. So it sounds like he's talking about Nero. And Nero was very definitely an agent of Satan. And the beast is depicted as if he is almost Satan incarnate. So it's a very evil number, obviously, but it's the name of a person. And it's not necessarily a name meaning Satan or anything like that, but if that's what you're wondering about.
That turned me up because, you know, I get people saying, Lucifer the devil, 666, March of the Beast. I knew the Beast.
A lot of people assume that Lucifer is Satan, and there's no biblical reason to assume that. The name Lucifer doesn't even appear in most Bibles. It does appear in the King James Version in one verse, and that is in Isaiah 14:12. And there it appears in a verse only because the King James translators did not translate all the Hebrew words. The word Lucifer is a Latin word, and it means morning star, or something very similar to that. Star of the morning, day star. Almost all modern translations translate the Hebrew into English when they're translating the Old Testament. And so they translate the Hebrew word into morning star. And you don't find the Latin word Lucifer there at all in any translation other than the King James, the New King James. You might find it in the New Living Translation and a few others. But most modern translations simply don't even have the word Lucifer, because it's a Latin word that should have been translated along with all the other words. And it means day star or morning star. So Lucifer isn't really necessarily a proper name. And it's not talking about the devil. The only passage where you find Lucifer in the King James Version is talking about the king of Babylon. It's not talking about the devil. So, you know, the idea that Lucifer is a name for Satan is strictly a human tradition. It doesn't have any biblical basis at all. Appreciate your call, Calvin. Tamara from Austin, Texas, or Tamara, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'll try to make a question very quick so I can take your answer offline.
Okay.
I am witnessing with a bill at work that believes that Jesus is the unique Son of God that did not pre-exist, that he's not part of the Godhead because God cannot die. I talked to her about the word in John 1. She says that's a translation issue, that it's only the word as it's spoken that the Father spoke in the beginning of the plan always of his Son. That's all that is. So I'm trying to witness that, and I've been struggling.
Well,
and so I'm asking for your advice and scripture evidence, if you can help me offline.
Sure. Thanks for your call. Well, I would say, first of all, I would go to the Old Testament, because that's where we find the predictions about the coming of the Messiah. And Jesus is the Messiah. And it sounds like she may not deny that he's the Messiah. She just doesn't believe he's God. But it says in Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7, in a passage about the Messiah, it says, "Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." These are all titles of Jesus, including the title the Mighty God, which I don't think would be something that God would look favorably on anyone using of themselves, because he said, "You have no other gods in my presence." For Jesus to be called the Mighty God and the Everlasting Father, it seems like those are terms that would very distinctly point to God, the Creator. Now, the New Testament uses all kinds of names for God in speaking of Jesus. He's called the Good Shepherd. He called himself the Good Shepherd. And yet God, in Ezekiel chapter 34 and 37, said that he's the one who would come and shepherd his people, Israel. God says, "I will shepherd my people myself." And Jesus said, "I'm the Good Shepherd. I'm the one." Jesus called himself the I Am in John 8:58. In the book of Revelation, he's called the beginning and the end, the first and the last. These are terms that Isaiah uses for Jehovah. There's a lot of references to Jesus as God. I'm sorry we don't have more time to get into it, but I do have a lecture on it at my website. If you go to thenarrowpath.com, go under topical lectures, and in the series Knowing God, there's a lecture on the deity of Christ that might be helpful to you. I'm sorry we're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593.